Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, Vatican Radio. Why don't I shine the spotlight on Pope Benedict XVI's The Infancy Narratives with the man who translated this book from German into English. He's Monsignor Philip Whitmore, and his is a familiar voice to regular listeners. I asked him to share with us some thoughts regarding this final volume in the Pope's Jesus of Nazareth trilogy. But a good start might be listening to Monsignor Whitmore reading a passage from chapter 3 of this book relating to the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem.
Augustine drew out the meaning of the manger using an idea that at first seems almost shocking, but on closer examination contains a profound truth. The manger is the place where animals find their food. But now, lying in the manger, is he who called himself the true bread come down from heaven, the true nourishment that we need in order to be fully ourselves. This is the food that gives us true life, eternal life. Thus, the manger becomes a reference to the table of God, to which we are invited so as to receive the bread of God. From the poverty of Jesus' birth emerges the miracle in which man's redemption is mysteriously accomplished.
Father, this book, focusing on the infancy narratives, goes by that title because it's inspired by the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, no?
Yes, those are the two Gospels which have stories about the birth of Jesus and the miraculous circumstances surrounding his birth. St. Mark begins straight away with the adult Jesus, and St. John, after his prologue, goes straight into the ministry of the adult Jesus. But it's, as you say, Matthew and Luke who have the infancy narratives.
Pope, of course, as we know, is an academic, and he's always written, or the whole of his life he's written and has taught at university, so he has this ability to communicate through words. How does he find the time now he's Pope with such a full schedule to write books?
It is extraordinary that he manages to do it, and even more extraordinary, I think, that he manages to read, because you see from some of the books in the bibliography that he's been reading books that came out in 2008 and 2011, so long after he became Pope, and he's quoting them, he's using them in these books. But part of the reason why he manages to do it is because when you read a book by the Pope, or indeed a book by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, as he was, what you're actually reading is, for the most part, transcribed speech. He doesn't actually write in the conventional sense. He dictates, and then people transcribe from the recording the text of the book. So that's why almost everything he produces has a real freshness, and it's really surprisingly readable, a lot of people say. It's been said of him that if you ask him a question, he stops and thinks for a while, and then he answers in complete paragraphs, beautifully constructed, just as he would have done when he was a university lecturer. So he has that remarkable ability, actually, to speak from notes, presumably, because he makes references and quotations. But basically, he speaks, and then other people write it down and prepare it for publication.
The book was written in German, and you translated it. How easy was that, or how difficult was that?
Well, I suppose I'm getting used to the Holy Father's German. I think he writes very, very beautifully in German. It's like music, and he plays little games with words sometimes when there's a verb that has a number of different prefixes which give it different meanings, and that's almost impossible to translate, because unless the language you're working with happens to have the same word games, you just lose that. You always lose something in translation. It's difficult in the sense that he packs an awful lot into each of his sentences, and the German language actually can cope with that because the structure is so clearly regulated that you can add all kinds of extra clauses, extra phrases, without the reader losing the sense of where the sentence is going. In English, if you start adding lots of extra clauses, you very quickly lose your way in a forest of words. So that element is also quite difficult. But I suppose what compensated for that is the clarity of his thought. You can see exactly what he's saying and why he's saying it and how it leads on to the point that he wants to make. And so then you've got something very, very clear to render in English. And sometimes you just have to take a step back and say, well, how would I have said that in English? And it comes out in quite a different order, but with the same linear thought sequence.
This book on the infancy narratives is the third and final volume of the Jesus of Nazareth trilogy. In what order would you suggest one read these volumes? I mean, the first one is from the baptism in the Jordan to the Transfiguration, so Jesus's public life, and the second was on Holy Week from the entrance into Jerusalem to the resurrection.
Well, I read them in the order in which they came out, so I read the first one when that's the only one there was, and then the second one, then this most recent one. But I honestly think you can read them in any order. I don't think any of them depend on the other volumes for a reader really to understand where the Holy Father's coming from. And I would say if you're starting with this trilogy at this time of year, when we're leading up to Christmas, then it's a very good idea to read the infancy narratives, because that will help with the spiritual preparation for the celebration of Christmas. And likewise, if you're reading one of them in Lent or in the lead up to Easter, then very good to read the one on Holy Week, from the entrance to Jerusalem to the resurrection. But I honestly think that you can read them in any order, and you're not at a disadvantage if you start with one rather than another.
I believe you translated Jesus of Nazareth, Holy Week, from the entrance into Jerusalem to the resurrection.
Yes, that's right.
Was the language similar?
Yes, it's very similar, really, and so that helps, of course, when one gets used to the Holy Father's way of expressing himself and his way of using language. It's a lot longer, of course, so it was a much bigger job. This one, just four chapters and an epilogue, and we had to do it rather quickly, so we were thankful that it wasn't too long.
These books, are they written for a general audience, or does the reader have to have some sort of theological background to be able to understand correctly?
I think they're written really for a general audience, but I'd have to qualify that. I'd have to say straight away that the Holy Father does use a certain amount of technical vocabulary, and partly for that reason, the publishers for part one and part two included a glossary at the end to explain terms that might be unfamiliar to a reader who hadn't read much theology before. And that, I think, is rather important, and indeed that would be one reason for starting perhaps with those volumes. I think it's also fair to say that you would need to understand a little bit about what people have been saying in the world of biblical scholarship, biblical criticism recently, because that helps you to understand quite where the Holy Father's coming from and what his particular angle is. Just to put it really very simply, a lot of the people writing about the Bible in the course of the 20th century were exploring the theological meaning of the gospel stories and making that a distinction between the theological meaning and what was actually history, what actually happened. And there's been a tendency to say that quite a lot of the stories in the Bible perhaps don't tell us what really happened, but they tell us what the early Christian community thought about them, what they believed about them, and so they've developed all kinds of extra layers. And while I think everyone would agree with that, where people differ perhaps is on what the actual historical basis was. And what the Holy Father wants to do is to say, yes, of course, the theological interpretation is absolutely essential. That's key to what the gospel writers were hoping or trying to express. But the historical content is also very important, and without that we lose touch with Jesus. So he wants to say in all three of these books, you can actually trust the Gospels to give us an accurate idea of what Jesus was really like. They don't simply tell you what the early Christian community believed about him, they also tell you about Jesus of Nazareth himself.
For example, we can speak about the virgin birth, no? Is that an example of this?
Well, that's a good example, yes, because there have been those who would argue that what we read about the virgin birth is not historically true, but that it's just a way in which the gospel writers expressed our belief that Jesus is truly God and truly man. Yes, he was conceived in the womb of Mary and born in the usual way and grew up as a child, but in order to express the fact that he was also the Son of God, they came up with this story. Well, the Holy Father says, no, it really has to be true, because otherwise it's not true to say he's true God and true man. And this really is a moment when God intervened in our history in a very, very remarkable, very dramatic way as part of his plan of salvation. And so Jesus really is the Son of God, and so the virgin birth has to be true in order to safeguard that belief. And he points out that this is something that a lot of people nowadays find very hard to accept, because people don't like the idea that God can intervene in history. But he says it's really a cornerstone of our faith that actually God can and occasionally does. And that if we deny that, if we say it isn't possible, we're really denying God altogether. We're saying he isn't God. He doesn't have power over creation. And of course, the Holy Father very forcefully says, oh, yes, he does.
There's a passage which tickled people's imagination when they read the Pope's book, and it concerns the crib and the presence of the ox and the ass. People misread the Pope's words there, perhaps saying that the Pope had thrown out the animals from the nativity scene.
And that's really not what he said at all. If you just have a look at what he wrote, you find his thought is always subtle, but it's always clear. It's always very easy to understand. There's no excuse, really, for some of the nonsense that people spoke about this. He points out that there's no mention in the Gospel, in Luke's Gospel, of animals, but there is, of course, mention of the manger. So that means that it's quite likely that there were animals around, because a manger is something that animals eat out of. But then, in a very characteristic way, Pope Benedict draws on other parts of the Bible from the Old Testament, and he says, for example, there's a verse in Isaiah, "The ox knows its owner and the ass its master's crib, but Israel does not know, my people does not understand." And so the Holy Father points out that the Church, reflecting on the circumstances of our Lord's birth, in the light of the Old Testament passages like that, saw an image of animals that perhaps would have been present, and that that was part of the way they reflected on the incidents of the Gospel. And he also draws on another prophecy which says, "In the midst of two living creatures you will be recognized." And that passage is a reference to the Ark of the Covenant and the two cherubs that you see on top of the Ark of the Covenant. So he's drawing on all sorts of strands of tradition here, and it's telling us all kinds of things about Jesus, such that the manger is like the Ark of the Covenant. It contains the presence of God himself. And similarly, with the ox and the ass, they can represent humanity made up of Jews and Gentiles. So there are all these layers of symbolism that are added and that deepen our understanding of the simple historical events.
I'm touching on events that people like to hear of, like, for example, the crib story and the ox and the ass, but also the Star of Bethlehem, which is a celestial event, is something that relates to people, doesn't it?
Yes, and you see how frequently the stars form a part of people's Christmas decorations and decorations of trees and so on. There's something about the image of the star that has certainly captured the imagination. The Holy Father writes very beautifully about the Star of Bethlehem. For one thing, he does believe there may have been such a star, in the sense that it's possible that there was a conjunction of planets that caused unusual brightness in the sky that would have happened round about that time, according to astronomical calculations. But it's the symbolic meaning that in a way is more important and more helpful than whether it was actually historically an event that could have been recorded by others. And he explains that the star, as a product of nature, as a product of creation, gave the wise men a certain amount of knowledge and led them some of the way towards finding Jesus. And they got as far as Jerusalem, which was reasonable enough because they were looking for a king of the Jews, and that's where the palace was. That was in the capital city. But then they had to ask for directions. Where do we go from here? And it was a prophecy from the book of Micah, "And you, Bethlehem, are by no means least among the tribes of Israel, for out of you will come a leader who will shepherd my people Israel." So it was God's revelation in prophecy that actually took them all the way to find Jesus. So creation led them a certain part of the way, and then revelation took over to bring them all the way to find Jesus.
So the Pope believes the Magi really existed?
He does, yes, yes. He doesn't insist on that. He says that some very reputable exegetes will say, well, no, this is a story that illustrates an important theological truth. And indeed, the theological truth is much more important than the simple fact whether these men actually did make the journey. But nevertheless, he points out that it's quite plausible that there were these three wise men from the East. And he talks quite a lot about traditions of scholarship and wisdom in the Near East, and that people were generally living in expectation of a great leader, a great saviour. Some people thought it was Augustus, some people thought it was another emperor, and of course we know that it was Jesus.
For each of the events we've just been speaking about, the Pope points out ways in which the Gospel stories draw on the Old Testament. But there are also references to contemporary history and literature from outside the Bible, no?
Yes, that's right. And indeed, the references to the Emperor Augustus received quite a lot of attention in his book, because you remember Luke tells us that the birth of Jesus took place while a census of the whole world was being taken by Augustus Caesar. So that puts the whole event in the context of Caesar's rule. And Augustus was famous for establishing the Pax Romana, the peace over the whole of the known world, effectively over the whole of the Roman Empire. And of course, Jesus is like the mirror image of that. He's not powerful or wealthy in the way that Caesar was. He's a tiny, defenseless, vulnerable child in a remote corner of the empire. But he actually brought a peace that far transcended the peace that Augustus brought. And he really did bring that peace to the whole world. So there's a kind of parallelism there between Caesar and Jesus. But the Pope also draws on an amazing passage from Virgil, which seems to be predicting the birth of a great leader, and even seems to suggest that it could be something to do with a virgin. So Christians have always seen this as a very remarkable anticipation of what we have in the Gospels, although clearly it's not sacred or inspired writing itself. So the Holy Father writes about that as well, and about numerous other writings and historical records from the period, just to fill out the background.
Would you like to read us one of your favourite passages?
Yes. This comes when the Holy Father is writing about the Annunciation to Mary of the birth of Jesus, and he quotes St. Bernard. In one of his Advent homilies, Bernard of Clairvaux offers a stirring presentation of the drama of this moment. After the error of our first parents, the whole world was shrouded in darkness under the dominion of death. Now God seeks to enter the world anew. He knocks at Mary's door. He needs human freedom. The only way he can redeem man who was created free is by means of a free yes to his will. In creating freedom, he made himself in a certain sense dependent upon man. His power is tied to the unenforceable yes of a human being. So Bernard portrays heaven and earth, as it were, holding its breath at this moment of the question addressed to Mary. Will she say yes? She hesitates. Will her humility hold her back? Just this once, Bernard tells her, do not be humble but daring. Give us your yes. This is the crucial moment when from her lips, from her heart, the answer comes. Let it be to me according to your word. It is the moment of free, humble, yet magnanimous obedience in which the loftiest choice of human freedom is made.
And warm thanks there go to Monsignor Philip Whittemore, who shared with us these thoughts on the final volume in the Pope's Jesus of Nazareth trilogy, The Infancy Narratives. Monsignor Whittemore is currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.